Well, it's been a long road from chapter 4 to this final chapter of this series of oracles against the unfaithful house of Israel. And I'll comment on that as we conclude this portion of the book of Ezekiel tonight. Now, as you can see from my reading of it, this chapter is clearly divided into two parts. Verses 1 to 14 are a parable setting forth the now beginning captivity in its final phase, together with an interpretation of it. And then in verses 15 through 27, we have the prophet acting out a kind of acted parable, which again is interpreted as applicable to what these people will experience as their nation is overthrown, when the magnitude of it all strikes their hearts with this horror. First of all, then, we look at the parable in the first 14 verses. Clearly here a specific revelation came to Ezekiel, no doubt while he was there by the river Chebar in Babylonia, in which it was revealed to him on the very day that Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem, not only that it had happened, but what the outcome of it would be. And as we will see later, this was to be the last thing that the prophet would say until all of these things were verified. So this was his last oracle to the nation of Israel, and that's undoubtedly why it concludes this long section until these things, the immediate ones, were fulfilled. The horror of this coming desolation is then depicted in a parable. What is left of the nation is likened to, quote, the choice pieces, verse 4. Put into it the pieces of meat, all the choice pieces, the leg and the shoulder. Fill it with the best of these bones. Now, it's my opinion that we have here a throwback to chapter 11, verse 3, where the prophet described the people in Jerusalem in their presumption that nothing like this could ever happen to them as saying the following. 11:3, they say, quote, will it not soon be time to build houses? This city is a cooking pot, and we are the meat. End of quotation. Therefore, prophesy against them, prophesy, son of man. Now, clearly, they presumed that however bad it got, they being there in the city were like something in the cooking pot that was safe and preserved from the really terrible burning in the fire. Something like that must have been behind this saying that they had. So here the prophet takes up their own saying and in this parable turns it against them. All right, he says, in effect, let Jerusalem be the pot. And you people here who pride yourself on being the best part of the nation, because, you see, they thought that's what they were, and that that's why nothing like this would happen to them. So they said, all right, you be the best pieces, the leg, the shoulder, and so on. Put them in this pot and stoke up the fire, because it's going to be cooked in a terrible fire. So he uses their own figure, in other words, to display the judgment now beginning. And in verses 6 through 12, this is then interpreted. And the reference in verse 7 is, I believe, a final reference to the brazen character of the evil then prevailing in the nation. When blood is shed, it cries out from the ground. But at least when blood is shed on the earth and covered up with the dust thereof, it's not such a brazen act. But when that blood is shed on a rock, as it were, out in the open and exposed light of the sun, it aggravates the sense in which it cries out to God for revenge. I believe that that is the prophet's picture here. As he says, the blood she shed is in her midst, poured on the bare rock, not on the ground where the dust would cover it, but on the bare rock, to stir up wrath and take revenge. So, this is a way of bringing out for the last time the aggravated character of the wickedness then prevailing in this nation. Then in verses 9 through 11, the Lord shows the severity of the desolation which is coming, which is to come. For he says, heap on the wood and kindle the fire, cook the meat well, mixing in the spices, to the point that the bones themselves are charred. Then set the empty pot on the coals till it becomes hot and its copper glows, so its impurities may be melted and its deposit burned away. In other words, this fire is going to be so hot that everything in that pot is going to really be charred and burned. So these people are here being shown the folly of their presumption, being in Jerusalem and the place of God's holy temple is not going to preserve them, and they are facing terrible judgment and annihilation. Verse 12 gives the reason. It has frustrated all efforts. Its heavy deposit has not been removed, not even by fire. So, in other words, all previous efforts of the Lord through chastisement and the like, seeing many of their fellows carried away to Babylonia already, these things had proved of no avail, so there's nothing left but this terrible cleansing fire that they assumed would never come upon them. And then in verses 13 and 14, you have a final summation. And this is not in parable language anymore, but in plain prose. Now your impurity is lewdness, because I tried to cleanse you, but you would not be cleansed from your impurity. You will not be clean again until my wrath against you has subsided. I, the Lord, have spoken. The time has come for me to act. I will not hold back. I will not have pity, nor will I relent. You will be judged according to your conduct and your actions, declares the Sovereign Lord. So, while God is long-suffering, patient, and merciful, there does come a point where the cup of iniquity is full, and then the Lord's cup of wrath and anger is also poured out to the full extent. And that is what has now come at this period in the history of the Old Covenant people of God. Now, in the second part of this chapter, you have the prophet's further delineation of this as he exhibits a strange behavior in the face of a tragedy that normally provokes great grief. This was, again, a special revelation that came to Ezekiel. Undoubtedly, he was there in his normal place in Babylonia with the people who had been banished from the land of Israel. And the Lord tells him one day that he's going to take away, in a moment, the delight of his eyes. And the delight of his eyes, mentioned there in verse 16, in verse 18, is clearly shown to be his wife. For he says, "So I spoke to the people in the morning, and in the evening my wife died. The next morning I did as I had been commanded." So, evidently, Ezekiel's wife was beautiful in his eyes and dearly loved. She was the delight of his eyes. And she was taken away suddenly by the Lord, and yet he was specifically forbidden in any outward way to mourn her departure. The Lord did not forbid him to grieve inwardly, as you can see there, but he was not allowed to do so outwardly. Verse 17 says, "Groan quietly, but do not mourn for the dead." That means that within inside of himself he was allowed to feel this, but mourning in the Old Testament period was never a purely inward thing. It was also expressed outwardly by tearing the garments and putting on sackcloth and ashes and things of that sort. He was not permitted in any way to outwardly manifest signs of grief. So it actually happened. Some commentators argue that this was simply stated by him as a kind of word parable, but it's my view that this actually did happen to Ezekiel, that he did actually experience this, and that he still, in obedience, did what the Lord commanded. And the people seeing this were amazed, naturally, and therefore sought an explanation. If you had known this prophet and seen his love for his wife and she suddenly died, and then you saw that the man made no outward sign of mourning whatsoever, you'd probably ask for an explanation. The explanation shows that God's sanctuary, the temple, was first of all the thing they were trusting in to protect them, and secondly, the supreme object of their pride and delight and affection. This is what the Sovereign Lord says, verse 21, "I am about to desecrate my sanctuary." That can only be the temple, which had not yet been destroyed, Solomon's temple. "The stronghold in which you take pride, the delight of your eyes." There's the very same phrase that was applied above to Ezekiel's wife. So what the wife was in the eyes of Ezekiel, the temple was in the eyes of these people, the ones that remained in the land of Palestine when Nebuchadnezzar came for this last siege, the object of your affection. But note also in that verse that the source of their grief was not merely the overthrow of the temple, but also this: the sons and daughters you left behind will fall by the sword. So the destruction of the temple of Solomon was to the nation of Israel equivalent virtually to the loss of a beloved wife, accompanied as it was by the loss of their sons and daughters. Why then do they not mourn? And yet we see that they do not. "And you will do," verse 22, "as I have done. You will not cover the lower part of your face or eat the customary food. the words of mourners being added is nevertheless an obvious sense. You will keep your turbans on your heads and your sandals on your feet. You will not mourn nor weep, but will waste away because of your sins and groan among yourselves. Why then do they not mourn? Well, the answer is, they waste away and groan. Literally, in the Hebrew, they rot away and groan. I don't know if any of you ever saw the series The World at War. If you did, it was a black and white television series some years ago. But in that, I remember they had some footage of the long lines of German prisoners being taken into Siberia by the Russians. And you could even see the expressions on their faces. Undoubtedly within they groaned, but there was no outward sign of grief and mourning. It was just a kind of dead, vacant stare. Because of the enormity of the calamity that had overtaken them, what normally would have caused great grief was suppressed. That may be the meaning here. I rather think it is. The other possibility is that when this happens, at last the message will get through. They will realize that they have sinned in a very horrendous manner against the living God, and it will be a sense of real repentance in their hearts, that is to say, grief and hatred of their own sins, which will have a greater power over them than the natural feeling of grief that they feel in the loss of temple and land. Indeed, both of these could be true, and I suspect were, because there were some who did, through this final chastisement, return wholeheartedly to the Lord. But either way, the meaning is clearly this. The nature of the calamity will be such that it will eclipse and suppress natural feeling. And indeed, I can think of one very vivid parallel that I have come across in my study over the years. Audrey might echo with this because she's been reading Josephus, but there's an account in Josephus of the way people acted during the final siege of Jerusalem by Titus. And it came to the place in that siege that things were so awful and the wrath of God so terrible upon the people that things that would cause you and I to sob with great grief had no effect on the people. People would die, little infants, parents, relatives, loved ones, and there was no expression of grief whatsoever. It was simply because the total calamity was so overwhelming and the effects of starvation so devastating that people were incapable any longer of expressing grief. So, which of these is exactly what is referred to here, or whether it is all of them, it's hard to say. We do know that this was a severe and terrible siege of Nebuchadnezzar. He did not show much mercy. And so I suspect that all of them played a part. So here Ezekiel says that he is a sign to you. Ezekiel, verse 24, will be a sign to you. And a sign is a kind of miniature picture representing something else. Well, that's exactly what he was. He was a miniature picture of what they themselves would soon be. You will do just as he has done. The word here is not the word for miracle, but the word in the Hebrew which refers to something that elicits a wonder as a reaction to it. In other words, when something of this nature happens, it causes any bystander in an adjacent nation, any observer who sees it, to marvel, to stand with wonder at it, because it's such a rare and awful thing. And when it happens, we are told, they will know that God is sovereign. That's the first thing. They will know that God is sovereign, that He really is the mighty God. They had forgotten that, but when this happens, they will remember this and they will know it. They will also hear Ezekiel again. Verse 26 says, on that day, and that means on the day when some runner arrives in Babylonia, probably near the river Chebar where they were, these people banished from Palestine by Nebuchadnezzar, and they didn't have any faster means of communication then, so it took a considerable time. And don't forget, they couldn't go right across the desert. They had to go up around the Fertile Crescent and down through that area of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, so it was a long, long journey. But anyway, on the day that that fugitive comes to give the news that all these things have happened, then, he says, at that time your mouth will be opened. Clearly then, the idea here is that from the time of this prophecy, which is here recorded, the mouth of Ezekiel was closed until the day of fulfillment. Now, if you look back in chapter 3, verse 26, we already have a prior warning of this. We read in verse 24, then the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet. He spoke to me and said, go, shut yourself inside your house, and you, son of man, they will tie you with ropes. You will be bound so that you cannot go out among the people. I will make your tongue stick to the roof of your mouth so that you will be silent and unable to rebuke them, though they are a rebellious house. But when I speak to you, I will open your mouth and you shall say to them, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. So we see there a preview of the fact that there would be a time when the Lord would close His mouth, silence him, and then again open it. So when this happens, they will know that He is the Sovereign Lord. The mouth of Ezekiel the prophet will be open again, and at that time the word that comes forth is of a different character than what we've been studying here, and we're going to see that. But this was the last word of Ezekiel to the people until these things had taken place. So, he says, you will be a sign to them that they will know that I am the Lord. So the third thing is that they know that He is their Lord. Now this completes this long section of oracles against the people of Israel. And while I am sure it has been difficult for you to endure, I congratulate you because many of you I see here tonight have persevered even to the end. Well, this is the end of this dark section. And one of the things we should learn from the fact that it was so prolonged is this. God takes it seriously. This disobedience of His old covenant people over such a long span of time in the face of such repeated signs of His mercy, compassion, and forgiveness. In other words, their extreme provocation of God. It was so important that God Almighty could not just talk about it briefly. He had to speak at length about it through His servant. And one of the lessons God would have us then to take from this is that we ourselves must take it with the utmost seriousness. The lesson of the apostasy of the Old Testament Israel is one of the great and enduring lessons of the Bible. Now, if you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I'd like to point this out in the way that the apostle himself does. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6. Now, these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Don't be idolaters as some of them were, and so on. Again, in verse 11 it says, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. But then right after that it says, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, but when you are tempted, He also will provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. So we are told in the Bible itself that these Old Testament records, such as the one we've been studying here in Ezekiel, have been written not for the benefit of Ezekiel. He didn't need to have it written. Not really for the benefit of those people. They heard the guy speak in person. No, they're written for us so that we could take heed. And so we really ought to take very careful note of what we've seen in these 20 chapters. All right. Now, here are some of the enduring lessons that I see in this portion of the Bible. First of all, real prophecy is very specific and self-attesting. No question about it, Ezekiel foretold precise events in a very precise way, so much so that all those people who saw it actually happen knew. Doesn't say they acknowledged God with worshipful hearts, but they knew that He was the living and true God. The second lesson that stands out to me in the entire section is this. A sure recipe for total disaster is presumption. As soon as we presume that such a thing as this could never happen to us, that we are the true church of God and that we are indefectible, as they have always said theologically, or as the Roman Catholic Church has said, we are the Church of St. Peter, and God has promised that nothing can ever go wrong with our church, so we don't have to worry about that. As soon as we have that kind of presumption, we are almost certain to face great disaster. What people ever had greater reason to presume than the Jews did? They had God's promise through Abraham, through David. They had the temple. They had the only divinely appointed house of worship on the face of the earth. They couldn't imagine that God would ever destroy that nation. But they were wrong. He did. The third lesson is this. It's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of God when His wrath is kindled. And the terrible disaster that has overtaken the old covenant people of God should serve as a warning to us of how great the magnitude of this is. Because to this day, the veil remains over their heart, and you know the sad history in between. A fourth lesson is this. God's faithful servants, as for example Ezekiel, are themselves called upon to suffer much in a time of corporate disaster. What I'm pointing out is that God did have His faithful servant in the midst of this, and that faithful servant also suffered because of the time in which he lived, among other things, the loss of his wife. A fifth lesson is this. Apostasy resulting in desolation because of God's judgment is worse than any other calamity. I think that is clearly seen in the way this is depicted. Because to lose the privileges they had was to lose that in which their eyes took delight, which was the object of their affection, the pride of their existence. That's what they lost. Number six, sometimes when it has all been said and they won't listen, it is time to be silent until God vindicates our witness. I believe there's a principle here that is applicable also in our life personally. You may have relatives to whom you have given faithful witness and they don't want to hear. Well, it may be that you should just then be silent until God acts in such a way as to vindicate the witness that you've given. Provided, of course, you have really given it. And finally, no matter what God's covenant people may do, one result is certain. God will vindicate His own glorious name. That is the one thing that is certain. These people are going to know that He is sovereign. And His cause is not going to perish. He will see to that. So we must never, for one moment imagine, however dark things may look, that the cause of God is in danger or that He will not be able to carry out His purpose in the history of the world. There are times when only sorrow and loss will make men see the value of the most precious of things. I'm told that this happened in Holland during the Second World War. Never did people value the privilege of worship so much as they did right in the middle of that war. Never were the churches so full with people hanging on every word that was spoken with authority. Finally, God has His servants who understand even in the darkest of times, and what a privilege it is to be one of God's servants who do understand. Now, all of this has been a rather dark portion of the Word of God because we concentrate on the negative, but we will soon see that in the midst of all this, God was preparing the way for a more glorious future. If you have your outlines, you'll notice that in the next several chapters, we deal quite briefly with the surrounding nations. They are not forgotten in God's judgment. Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistia, Tyre, Sidon, Egypt. All of these, they also come in for God's judgment. But rightly so, would you not agree, to whom so much has been given, of them much more is required. And that's why 20 chapters tell us about God's judgment of Israel. Maybe part of one chapter is enough for Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And then comes, from chapter 33 to 39, the prophecies of the restoration. And there we're going to spend a lot of time on the positive. And then following that, from 40 to 48, the glorious vision of the new covenant. Under the structural terminology of what they knew in that day. So we will soon see that the prophet went on after his mouth was opened to say many very encouraging and hopeful things, and I hope that we can do justice to them when we come to them. I don't know if there are any questions.